I'll have the marshal call the case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Wilkie, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A20-0816, State of Minnesota versus Sambaugh-Kunlebout.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I know that you both are very familiar with our procedures, including our Zoom procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes, 5 minutes rebuttal for appellant. And please state your name before you begin your arguments because these are being recorded and will be posted on our website. And with that, Mr. Lozo, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Adam Lozo and I represent the appellant Sambaugh-Kunlebout. Mr. Kunlebout was spending the night at his girlfriend Terry Van Lo's home when, after midnight and without a warrant, two police officers entered her home, woke her, interviewed her, and eventually searched her room, finding several containers and bags that they then searched through. One of those bags contained a gun and ammunition that the state charged Mr. Kunlebout with possessing. The issue is whether, when police began searching Van Lo's room, they had reasonable suspicion she was engaged in criminal activity. The post-conviction court concluded a propane-powered torch that was on the floor near the foot of Van Lo's bed established that necessary reasonable suspicion she had committed a crime. That conclusion was wrong, and the search was unlawful.
You agree, Mr. Lozo, that we're going to be reviewing this as a de novo review?
That issue of objectively reasonable suspicion, I agree, yes.
So the issue, as far as I can see, the issue comes down to our determination on whether the officer had reasonable suspicion to conduct the search.
Yes, whether there was objectively reasonable suspicion. As the post-conviction court recognized, the officer didn't actually base the decision to search on seeing this torch. The officer had intended to search and made the decision to search before he even arrived at the house.
And that's because the girlfriend or significant other or friend of your client had signed away her ability to object to a search by entering and being a part of the drug court program, correct?
Well, the reason that the police believed that they could do a suspicionless search was because his significant other, Ms. Van Lo, was participating in drug court. I would disagree. I certainly disagree that she signed away any privacy rights or rights to constitutional rights to not have her home searched on a suspicionless basis.
I don't understand that you're arguing, and if you are, correct me, that your client's reasonable expectation of privacy is not directly related to the fact it was her bedroom.
He
had a bag in there, he had that backpack thing.
Right.
But you're not saying that they, if we say and agree that the girl's search was reasonable, you're not saying that that backpack for some reason stood alone or wasn't a part of that search?
No, the claim turns on the fact that the search of Ms. Van Lo's room was unconstitutional.
Right. The reason I say that is because the videotape, the room is somewhat of a hoarder room, if I can call it that. There was a lot of junk. Okay, thank you.
Yes, I think that's accurate. So yes, the claim is based and always has been on the basis that that police needed reasonable suspicion that Ms. Van Lo was engaged in criminal activity to search her room, and that they didn't have that objectively reasonable suspicion when they performed the search.
So can I break this down just a little bit more, Mr. Lozo? So there's several increments in time where I'm questioning, is this where the Fourth Amendment violation is, or is that where the Fourth Amendment violation mm-hmm. is? I mean, we have the initial, I'm going to the house, I'm let into the house by mom, I'm going to the room, I'm standing in the doorway of the open room. Where in this continuum of events are we talking about that's where the Fourth Amendment violation occurred?
So following the post-conviction court's findings, the moment that this court is considering is the moment when the officer begins to search the room.
You're conceding then that the up until the point that the officer gets to the doorway of her room, all that's fine, right?
The initial entry at the post-conviction court, I did challenge the entry into the home and the entry into the room. The post-conviction court found, as a matter of fact, that those were made pursuant to consent. So no, I'm not arguing that that was wrong. So I am conceding that under the post-conviction order, that is okay.
Okay, so then explain to me why it is that if the officer is legally on the premises and inside of the house, that the officer's ability to search one of the rooms in the house is somehow limited because once they're lawfully there.
So if the officer presumptively needs a warrant to search a house,
consent to search. So if you're conceding
not conceding consent to search. No.
You that said that the grandma, you're not challenging the grandma's authorization to come into the house. And right. You're not arguing the consent to enter the bedroom.
Right.
So what you're getting at then is once he entered the bedroom and saw the propane torch, that was not in and of itself enough to go further?
Right. The officer needs a warrant to search the room. Consent is a warrant exception.
But why does he need consent to search the room when he's already been let into the house and you're not challenging his presence in the house? That's what I'm concerned about. Because bear with me for a second, because if we start saying that you're in the house and you're lawfully in the house, but now you need a warrant to search every individual room in the house, that's a sea change in my view.
No, that's not a sea change, Your Honor. Any consent that's given, the consent of the police's action doesn't go beyond the consent that's given. And I think Mr. Smith would agree with this. He can correct me if I'm wrong, but that simply consenting to enter a house is not consent to search everything within that house. Those are two very different things. The Fourth Amendment protects against the entry into the house and protects against a search to the house. And I'm not challenging the district court's finding that there was consent to enter the house, but the police would still need a warrant to search the house or to search the room. And the post-conviction court specifically found that the police did not have valid consent to search the room.
Then we go back to the torch or whatever it was in the room. And I know it's been called mm-hmm. two different things, but you know, we have this officer who testifies that based on his training and experience that these torches, the one that he saw on the floor, commonly used in connection with illegal controlled substances. Isn't that enough right there? He says that's what he knows the purpose of that torch to be. It may have other uses, but because of the fact that he's relying on his experience and says this, isn't that enough then for the warrantless search?
No, Your Honor, and there are multiple reasons for that. The first reason is that the incriminating nature of the item isn't immediately apparent, like it would be, for instance, if it was like a meth pipe or if he had seen methamphetamine in the room. The officer certainly testified that in his experience, butane torches, which are a different thing than the propane tank with a torch tip attached, that was actually at issue in this case, are commonly used for that purpose. But as for instance, the Supreme Court said in Britain, and as this court said in Bergerson, just because someone is engaged in lawful activity or possesses a lawful item that might have illicit uses or that in an officer's experience might be used in an illicit way, that is not enough on its own to establish that lawful conduct establishes reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. With regard to the officer's description of it's more common to see this in a room of someone who uses drugs than someone who doesn't, that's very similar to the testimony that the Supreme Court found didn't establish reasonable suspicion in Britain. In Britain, the police made a stop of a vehicle based on the fact that the vehicle had a broken window that the police officer testified in his experience is a common sign that the vehicle has been stolen. That's just like, and the Supreme Court said that that's not enough. It has to establish objectively reasonable suspicion that lawful and innocent conduct is actually a sign of criminal behavior.
I won't argue Britain as compared to the facts of this case, but let's talk about what I think is one of the most important features here is that any expectation of privacy was signed away by virtue of the girlfriend consenting to a search at any time as far as compliance with drug court. I mean, is that not her consent? And search, because you can do it anytime.
No, Your Honor, because that's the exact same language that this court found did not allow a suspicionless search in Heaton. That's exactly where Heaton comes into this case. In Heaton, this court examined that exact same language.
Heaton was a parole violator. So, you know, and I think the Heaton, if I remember the Heaton statement, they kind of went up the notches. Somebody that's on parole has less expectation than somebody that's, and they kind of went on. But, you know, here we have someone who in order to be a part of this program has agreed. I don't know that Heaton necessarily says that she doesn't and has not waived that away.
Your Honor, she never agreed to a suspicionless search. She agreed to a search, quote, at any time, as this court interpreted in Heaton, means a search based on reasonable suspicion at any hour of the day or night. Ms. Van Lo never agreed to a suspicionless search. That's not what the language of the search condition says. Instead,
it uses the distinction, though, counsel, between, I mean, the you know, we're a little handcuffed here because the document, the drug court participation agreement, as it is titled, is unsigned. We don't have a record as to what, how those circumstances came to be, whether she signed off on this document, but presuming that her signature is actually affixed to this document at some point in time, and it is labeled drug court agreement. Is there a distinction between the fact that she had to agree to these conditions as opposed to them being imposed upon her as part of the conditions of probation or a parole condition? Does that make a difference in terms of the consent?
So first of all, Your Honor, I will say that I believe a record was made at the post-conviction hearing that this document is the one that governed Ms. Van Lo's conditions.
Yes, so, but it's not clear as to when she signed it. That's my
right. And I guess my answer to that second point of that question, after clarifying the record, is that no, it doesn't make a difference whether she had to sign these conditions or whether they were imposed upon her, because the language of the conditions is exactly the same as in Heaton. In Heaton, this court said this condition means you need reasonable suspicion to search. And the language is the exact same. It doesn't lessen the constitutional standard, just like in Heaton. It doesn't purport to allow suspicionless searches. It doesn't alter the standard. Just like in Heaton, whether she agreed to the condition or whether it was imposed on her, it doesn't matter, because all she was agreeing to or having imposed on her was a reasonable suspicion standard. So in this case, if the search doesn't meet that standard, that constitutional standard, it was invalid. And to go back to, we spoke a little bit about Britain.
I'm sorry, I just want to ask about the totality of circumstances, because I know you're focused exclusively on the officer saw the torch and that's what sparked the search. But I mean, aren't we discounting and distinguishing it from Britain, discounting all of the things that the officer knew before he even got to the house? Like, she's in drug court, she's consented, or she has agreed to a search at any time. I should not use the word consent, agreed to a search at any time. There was a drug deal that he was dealing with immediately prior to going to the house. So aren't all of those part of the totality that we should be looking at too?
Well, with response to those three different things that you just brought up, first of all, the language of the condition we already discussed. What condition she has doesn't add to or subtract from, well, it doesn't add anything to whether there's reasonable suspicion. With regard to the fact that she's on drug court, I'll come back to that in a moment. With regard to the fact that he interacted two blocks away in public with these other people, one of whom had used drugs, as the post-conviction court found, that adds nothing to reasonable suspicion that Ms. Van Lo has actually engaged in any criminal activity. The post-conviction court correctly noticed and recognized, and the officer candidly testified that he didn't know anything about what Ms. Van Lo had been doing. These people didn't have, all he described it as was, quote, familial associations with Ms. Van Lo. He didn't have any information about any contact with them. He had never encountered them at her house. The fact that he encountered these other people in public blocks away doesn't add anything to reasonable suspicion. And I agree that this court should and has to focus on the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, I think that actually helps show why this search is unlawful. Certainly, Ms. Van Lo's on drug court. That shows nothing more than at some point in the past, she has been convicted of a drug crime or placed on probation for a drug crime. We have no idea how recent any drug-related activity on her part was. That differentiates this case from, for instance, Lugo, where there was a recent arrest for drug possession. It even differentiates it from Deed, where the Supreme Court found that there wasn't enough recency and the police had probable cause at that time to arrest the guy for drug possession. As I conclude in these last few seconds here, I would like to point to a lot of other aspects of the totality of the circumstances that do have to be considered. Before police did this search that is claimed to be justified by reasonable suspicion Ms. Van Lo had engaged in a crime, they interacted with Ms. Van Lo. She wasn't impaired. She wasn't intoxicated. They walked through the house. They saw no evidence or any information of any other criminal behavior that night. There was no other objective indication of drug use or paraphernalia anywhere else in the house or room. And the officer testified that such torches are usually found in conjunction with paraphernalia. The torch was found at the foot of the bed, on the floor. It wasn't, for instance, on her bedside table. It's a big, bulky propane tank with a torch tip, not a handheld lighter style torch. My time has expired. I'm happy to answer any other questions on rebuttal. Or any other questions say, now, if you want to ask.
And it's not a question, it's just a comment. I don't think there would have been any room on her night table for that torch, just based on the stuff in the room.
There were lots and lots of diverse items in the room, certainly, Your Honor.
One might say piles of diverse items.
One might, and one might have.
Mr. Smith, are you ready to proceed?
I am. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. And while the conversation has focused a lot on the ins and outs of the particular confluence of the law of search and seizure and this particular fact scenario, I want to draw us back to the overarching question here, which is whether trial counsel's performance was constitutionally deficient when he failed to move to suppress the evidence in this case based on a theory that the search was unconstitutional. And this is not a case where defense counsel conducted no investigation. He reviewed all of the disclosure, which included the police reports. It also included the body camera footage, which we've all had the opportunity to see, which captured the entire event here. He's an experienced defense attorney who's been an attorney for over 20 years, who's been a public defender for 17 or 18 of those years, and has made countless suppression motions at countless omnibus hearings. And he testified that he is familiar with the well-settled law of search and seizure. And based on his review of the disclosure, based on his knowledge of the law, he concluded in his professional judgment that it was appropriate to not challenge the search in this case. And the only question is whether that was a reasonable professional judgment on his part. And I think the fact that the district court concluded that the issue of consent, at least for entry and into the house and entry into the room, was a close call. And the fact that we're making some very fine distinctions between parolees, probation officers, and as I've argued, drug court participants who are, I maintain, are in a different class, that we are far beyond the question of objectively deficient performance. Counsel exercised his judgment. And the fact that other attorneys after the fact may disagree and would have done something different and might reach different conclusions about the ultimate merits of a motion to suppress demonstrates that his performance here was not objectively unreasonable. It's not as if Mr. Kuhn-Labut went to trial with no attorney at all. It's not as if he received no assistance from counsel on this issue. He received the exercised professional judgment of his trial attorney. Whether he disagrees with that or not doesn't establish his disagreement with that, doesn't establish that counsel was ineffective for raising this issue. And I submit that if, as appellant urges, this performance of counsel here is objectively unreasonable, you can't craft a rule of law that would make any failure to make a suppression motion not objectively unreasonable. And that goes far beyond Strickland. It goes far beyond Kimmelman. In fact, Kimmelman makes it clear that the failure to make even a likely to succeed suppression motion is not per se ineffective assistance of counsel. It's not per se objectively reasonable. This case isn't Kimmelman. Kimmelman was a case where the defense attorney didn't even know that a search had occurred. He hadn't received any discovery. He hadn't requested any discovery because he thought the government would just turn over the inculpatory evidence. And in that jurisdiction, there was no requirement that it do so. And so the attorney in Kimmelman goes into trial, the day of trial, unaware of a search, unaware that there was any basis to make a suppression motion, and therefore didn't exercise professional judgment at all. And that's not the case here. An experienced attorney reviewed the disclosure and based on that, based of his knowledge of the law, appellant makes much of the fact that he didn't do any additional research. But the law of consent, the law of search and seizure generally, is well settled. And he didn't need to do research. Just like when you go out to ride a bike after a long winter, you don't have to research how to ride a bike. Counsel exercised his judgment. He did what the Constitution requires, and the appellant did not receive ineffective assistance of counsel. Moreover, as I pointed out in my brief, this case is distinguishable, and as some of the judges have touched upon in the questioning, is distinguishable from Heaton on the basis of the fact that the girlfriend here was a participant in drug court.
And so, counsel, you did mention, I mean, I appreciate the argument framing the case for us as a post-conviction matter. It's very helpful. But I want to turn to the ultimate question of, did we make a mistake here, or did counsel make a mistake here in not pursuing the suppression motion, because it would have ultimately been successful? And you mentioned that you wanted to, that you're advocating for a different treatment of drug court participants, or as everyone is conceding here, a drug court probationer, as opposed to a regular probationer or a parolee. And so I want to know, number one, why? And number two, what's the legal basis for that distinction?
Well, to be clear, I'm not asking this court to actually rule in this case on the different treatment of the drug court probationer, because I don't think that's necessary, given the actual framing of the issue. Given the fact that the question is whether it was reasonable for counsel to not make a suppression motion here, I don't think we have to reach that fact. I think it's enough to recognize that there's a legitimate question about whether drug court participants should be treated differently. And I think the legal basis for that is when we go back to Anderson and we go back beyond that to Knights, where both our Supreme Court and the US Supreme Court have recognized that you have to weigh the intrusion against the state interest. And that we've recognized probationers and parolees are somewhat different. And under that balancing test, what Knights tells us we have to do is we have to make a balancing test. And Anderson is very careful. Anderson says in this particular case, this particular search of this particular probationer has to have at most reasonable suspicion. Given that, we have to look here at and conduct that balancing test anew, because this is different. This isn't simply a probationer. We have drug court participants who have voluntarily agreed to very specific conditions. Yes.
Part of the issue that I have with that argument is that this is such a skinny record about what drug court is like in Nobles County. We don't have a signed participation or probation agreement. We don't know if it's like some drug courts where it's a diversion program, so it's pre any plea. We don't know if it's post plea. We don't know anything about how it functions in Nobles County. And so I'm not willing to hang my hat on drug court probation status or not here. The record is too sparse to do that.
Well, and I understand that concern, but I think that just goes back into the question of the reasonableness of counsel's judgment. And remember, this is a post-conviction relief case where it's presumed that counsel's performance was constitutionally adequate.
But that said, in following up on Judge Riley's question, so in this context where we're at now, the ineffective assistance of counsel, whose burden would it have been to have taken that skinny record and made it a little bit fatter?
It would be the appellant's burden, because the appellant has to demonstrate that his counsel's performance was deficient. And it's the state doesn't have any burden in post-conviction relief proceedings unless that burden has been shifted by the court. And this is not a case where the burden has been shifted. The entire burden was on the appellant here. He has to overcome the strong presumption of reasonableness of counsel's performance. And the burden to make that record is on the defendant. So the failure to have the record here demonstrates that appellant hasn't shouldered his heavy burden of demonstrating that his attorney's performance was deficient. Because the attorney, we don't know those things, but what I can tell you is that it's reasonable for the attorney to at least make a judgment that based on drug court, this isn't a motion I have to make. That it's, because if that's a reasonable professional judgment, the fact that we might want it to have been done differently or would have gone about it doing it differently ourselves doesn't mean that counsel's performance was deficient. Again, that's why I'm saying I'm not asking this court to actually conduct the balancing test. It doesn't have to. All it has to do is recognize that that was a factor that plays into the mix here. And it wasn't, counsel's performance wasn't deficient when he failed to bring this motion. And appellant had the burden to demonstrate that it was. And he's simply assumed without demonstrating that Heaton is the relevant standard.
So counsel, I see that you're about 4 minutes left with your time. And I mean, I want to talk about the circumstance in the event that we do get all the way down the road to determine whether reasonable or articulable suspicion exists in this particular case. Can you tell me, and I know Mr. Lozo has attempted to impeach all of the circumstances that would have given rise to reasonable suspicion in this particular case. Tell me your best summary of what those circumstances would be that would have informed a justifiable search in this particular case.
Certainly, and for the most part, it's a point by point disagreement with Mr. Lozo. He's trying to isolate and dismiss all of the circumstances. Quite frankly, everything the officer knew from the time of his contact with known associates out on the street a couple of blocks away, up until the point in time when he starts searching, is relevant and is the totality of the circumstances. And just because any of those facts by themselves might not give rise to reasonable articulable suspicion, it doesn't mean that there isn't. So we have these known associates that have known connections with this address that are nearby. One of them is under the influence of drugs. We also have the fact that the girlfriend is a drug court participant. And we know, because the officer testified about this, people are in drug court because they have a high risk of relapse, they have high needs. And so this is an intensive program to help them maintain their sobriety. So we know she's a known drug user. The fact that trying to distinguish this case from Lugo on the basis that Lugo had a recent arrest, that means there was probable cause to believe he had possessed drugs at some point in time. The state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that in the relatively recent past, we're on probation after all, the girlfriend possessed drugs. And we know, because the record establishes, that she was placed in drug court. And we know that people are placed in drug court because they have a high risk of relapse. And we have those facts coupled with the officer's observation on the scene, taken together, with his observation of the torch. And yes, the record, there's confusion. The terms butane and propane are kind of used interchangeably. It's clear from the officer's testimony that he's testifying about this kind of torch and his knowledge about what these kinds of torches, the one he found in the room, are used for. And he testified that he doesn't usually find those in bedrooms of people who aren't drug users. And he testified that he often finds them in conjunction with other drug paraphernalia. Now, the fact that he couldn't see other drug paraphernalia doesn't negate reasonable suspicion. All it means is he didn't have probable cause to search the room rather than reasonable suspicion. Had he saw an actual meth pipe on the floor, we wouldn't be having a conversation at all, because we would have sailed way past reasonable suspicion. The only question here is whether the objective facts made it so that the officer's decision was based on more than mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity. And this court, unlike the Oregon court that appellant relies on, does defer to the officer's experience and training and the inferences drawn therefrom. It's been consistent about doing so. And this is not simply an ordinary item standing alone. Its place and location is unusual. We have known facts about the individual in whose room it's found. That takes this case beyond Bergerson and squarely into the realm of reasonable articulable suspicion. If there isn't reasonable articulable suspicion based on this combination of facts with particularized information related to this particular defendant and the officer's training and experience, the things that appellant is asking for would collapse the standard of reasonable articulable suspicion into probable cause, and it wouldn't do any work. I would simply ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Lozo?
Thank you. With regard to the record, on page 5 of the evidentiary hearing transcript, it's noted that the parties specifically stipulated that the drug court agreement entered as an exhibit at the post-conviction hearing contains the search condition that governs the search in this case. Parties stipulated that. Mr. Smith agreed to that. There was no objection. Parties agreed to that. If there is any other information that would provide a defense of the search, as far as something about drug court goes, that would have been the state's responsibility to enter that. The parties agreed that this condition governed the search condition in this case. And with respect to that, this is the same condition, not to be clear, not identical wording, but it is materially identical to the condition that this court interpreted in Heaton. That makes it different from the condition in Knights and Anderson, both of which purported specifically to eliminate suspicion. The Supreme Court of the state and the federal government didn't go there. They said that we're going to analyze whether reasonable suspicion is required. The condition here is just like the one in Heaton. It is not like the ones in Knights and Anderson. Heaton controls. And that's part of why counsel's performance here was deficient. Counsel testified that he couldn't remember whether he ever looked at the search condition that the officers relied on in making the search in this case. Counsel also testified, of course, as Mr. Smith said, that his determination of the suppression issues here was based on his knowledge of the, quote, well-settled law of consent, which, of course, the post-conviction court found was wrong. The post-conviction court found that valid consent to search this room was not given. And to go back to something that we discussed earlier, I'll just point the court also to just one example, State v. Bunce, a decision of this court from 2003 that clarifies that consent is limited to its scope and consent to enter is not consent to search. I just thought I'd put that citation out there. So on that point, I don't think that, you know, the fact that counsel has experience isn't relevant under Supreme Court precedent to whether his performance in this case was reasonable or correct. And the fact that counsel testified that the reason he waived this issue was because he believed it was made pursuant to consent, when the post-conviction court found on the basis of the exact same evidence that counsel looked at that that was not correct, shows that his performance was insufficient. We're not looking at a case here where on post-conviction we dug up all sorts of extra evidence and presented new evidence that counsel didn't have. We presented the exact same video that he said he watched and said, look at this video and determine whether there's valid consent. And the post-conviction court said there was not valid consent to search. Of course, we're now here talking about whether there is an alternative justification that the officers, of course, did not actually rely on in doing this search, but whether there's the alternative justification of reasonable articulable suspicion. And on that point, I would just refer to some of the arguments that I made before and emphasize once again that the things that happened before the officers came to the house are not part of any valid consideration as to whether there's reasonable suspicion here. Absolutely none of those things are specific to Ms. Van Lowe. Absolutely none of those things are any information about what she was doing that night, where she was. Those are facts that had to do with what other people who are associated with her family, not with her specifically, familial associations to the place where she lives. That does not add anything to reasonable suspicion that Ms. Van Lowe was engaged in criminal activity that night. One last point that I wanted to reply to. The cases that counsel referred to, or the principle that it's not always per se ineffective assistance not to bring a suppression claim that might win. That's true, because there are cases where you could bring a winning suppression claim and it wouldn't have an effect on the outcome of the case. In a case like this, where a suppression claim, the one that we've raised on post-conviction, would result in suppression of the evidence of the petitioner's guilt, is a different situation. So I agree that there are cases, perhaps a wide range of cases, where a suppression motion could be deemed not unreasonable to waive or to forfeit because it wouldn't actually affect the outcome of the case. But that's not the situation here. And unless this court has other questions, I'm happy to submit it on the basis of the arguments we've made.
Seeing no other questions, I want to thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. It is always a pleasure to have both of you appear in our court, and we will get our decision out within the 90 days. That concludes the oral portion of our calendar, and we will adjourn to consider our non-oral cases.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.